Mein Gast Brian Morrissey ist einer der bekanntesten Medienjournalisten in den USA. Er war über lange Geschäftsführer und Chefredakteur von DigiDay, einem Digitalmagazin, das sich ja in den letzten 10 Jahren mit digitalen Geschäftsmodellen auseinandergesetzt hat und quasi täglich von der gesamten Medienbranche in den USA, aber eben auch in Europa viel gelesen wird. Und kurz vor der Pandemie hat er seinen Job hingeschmissen, um sich selbstständig zu machen und hat einfach einen Newsletter auf der Plattform Substack gestartet, nennt sich The Rebooting und hat ähnlich wie Blaupause auch einen Podcast inzwischen, die sogenannte The Rebooting Show. Und Brian ist sehr gut darin, jede Woche zu reflektieren, was sich gerade tut in den digitalen Medien. Und er bezeichnet seine Zielgruppe als alle Leute, die daran interessiert sind, wie man heutzutage nachhaltig digitale Geschäftsmodelle mit Medien aufbauen kann. Man könnte sagen, dass er etwas Ähnliches macht wie ich mit Blaupause in Deutschland, aber natürlich sehr viel größer für einen größeren Markt und auf einem ganz anderen professionellen Niveau. Deswegen sind auch manche der Themen im Podcast möglicherweise nicht sofort verständlich. Ich empfehle dazu, den Blaupause-Newsletter anzugucken, wo ich einige der Begriffe, die möglicherweise nicht allen von euch Hörern bekannt sind, nochmal zu erklären. Als erstes habe ich Brian nach Semaphore gefragt. Das ist ein neues Magazin von Justin Smith und Ben Smith, die beide sehr bekannte amerikanische Medienunternehmer bzw. Journalisten sind, übrigens nicht verwandt. Und ich habe Brian gefragt, was denn sein Eindruck ist am zweiten Tag, nachdem Semaphore gerade erschienen war.
You know, it's funny because the way they launched, I think, was interesting in that there was a lot of hype around it. And that has a benefit because you can lock in a lot of sales deals and stuff. But, you know, the downside of that is a lot of people will end up, you know, getting sick of it and say bad things about it. Ultimately, it doesn't matter in the long run. I think it's an interesting product, and I'm really glad that people are starting new media businesses again. And I don't think we've seen like a wave of media businesses that have begun like this in the last like 10 years. And I think we're going to see even more new models like emerge. And I think what's interesting to me is the approach they're taking is very informed, from my point of view, by what we're seeing with Substack and what we're seeing with the rise of the creator economy. And I feel like it's not going to be like a revolution or something like this, but people are if you're launching a media business now, it's going to look a lot more like Substack than it will like BuzzFeed.
And actually, that's my next question, because it's kind of a similar business to the one that you're running, right? You
Well, it's a
actually,
little bigger.
sure. I mean, it's their try to scale the Substack model,
Yeah.
isn't it?
I think you're seeing a lot of media businesses like that. I mean, Axios in some way what is similar to that, in that you know, they put people a little bit more at the forefront than typical publishing businesses. But I think you're going to see, you know, people inherently trust other people more than just faceless institutions. And you know, that happening across like all of the creator economy, it makes sense that it would come to all areas of publishing. So I think it just speaks to like where the media industry is right now. Whether it'll work or not, I have no idea. It's like, you know, they have to execute on because there's a lot of existing publications that are serving very similar needs to the one that they're claiming that they're going to serve.
I mean, they're claiming like a global audience, right? And breaking news.
You know, they didn't recruit those type of people.
And why is that? Is that a question of money and what you can pay those
I
reporters
mean, I
or?
think it's a very expensive proposition. I mean, they raised $25 million, but that goes pretty quickly,
They were
particularly these
trying to raise
days.
much more, right?
Yeah, and so, you know, they're launching with a staff of 60. You know, that's an expensive proposition. They have to sell a lot of ads to support that because they don't have subscriptions yet. They'll do events, but you know, I think the models that you'll see emerge are going to be much more leaner, I feel like, than other models from a previous era. So fewer people, more efficient with how with infrastructure and the costs associated with infrastructure. To run a global news operation on the scale of a New York Times or a CNN, it's just so much bigger. But I see them slotting in more closely to, like, you know, The Economist or something like that, where you don't need 1,000 journalists necessarily. And they'll just pick, like, high value niches within, you know, the global news ecosystem.
Yeah. Whereas The Economist is very traditional, right? You don't even see the names of the authors.
That's why I think it reminds me a little bit of, and I know Justin sort of didn't agree necessarily, but it's kind of like what Quartz was supposed to be, right? And Quartz didn't work for a bunch of different reasons. They got caught in the middle to some degree. But to me, this kind of feels like a do-over for Quartz in some ways. And look, there's room for that, for sure. I just think that, you know, now, particularly with, like, newsletters, it's a lot clearer the path for how you create these kind of brands.
I mean, you are running a creator economy business, sort of, right? do you like that term?
I don't like the creator economy. To me, it's just because it's hard, because you lump in stuff that, like, you know, people do with, like, B2B newsletters with YouTube stars, right? And they're very different businesses and very different approaches. I do think overall, you know, B2B used to exist sort of apart from B2C. Like, the things that people were focused on in consumer media were totally different than the things that people were focused on in business media. And the types of products that you consume, media products, as a consumer, were very different than the kinds you did for your business. Mm-hmm. I think my theory is that sort of social media erased all of that, and that it's just, you consume content for your job, you consume content because you're interested in it, and the expectations are pretty much the same. And so I think that has changed B2B media. And so one of the trends that I see going on is this shift from institutions to individuals, and that's happening all across media. And so I think it makes sense to try to lean into those kind of, like, trends that are happening. And I think you're seeing that. I mean, some of the most successful Substacks are in the business area. They're focused on, there's a lot in politics, but there are a lot of people who are building successful models that are using newsletters. And I think the good thing about newsletters is you really take out a lot of the costs of operating a media business. And I think what Substack did that was really important is they made it completely easy and completely inexpensive to start a media business.
And that's what everybody was really excited about, or still is. But you, if I read your newsletter correctly, you seem to be a little bit disillusioned at times. I read you.
I think it's because I moved back to New York from Miami.
I don't see the sun.
I need to get the sun.
You wrote something about create economy, which is actually the gig economy, right?
Yeah.
Which,
well, that's where I see it going, I think, in some ways.
But has it always been there, been the same thing? And we only thought, you know, here's the bright future where we can cut out the publishing houses as middlemen.
Yeah.
And do our own thing.
Was that
an illusion somehow?
To some degree. I think the illusion was that this would be something that applied to thousands, tens of thousands of people. And there's a power law, and, you know, you go to, like, certain Substack people who, you know, make $1 million or more a year with a newsletter and a podcast, but they're the exception. And, you know, the much more common ones, you know, success is not nearly that. It's like, you know, $75,000 or $100,000 a year. So I just think it was kind of oversold a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And
how about your own experience? I mean, did you plan this to be something else, or is it working out just like you wanted it to?
Yeah, exactly as I expected. Okay. No, I'm not, just kidding. I mean, everything works out differently. I mean, what I wanted to see was, could I create a product that I wanted to make? I hadn't been writing regularly for 10 years, so getting back into writing was like an experience, comes back to you. And then I wanted to see if there was a business model to build around that. And, you know, I've seen that there is, because, you know, as long as you can reach high value people within a specific area, and particularly if they're, you know, difficult to reach and there's a lot of people who need to sell things to them, there's a good business model to be had. And so far that's working. I think what happens inevitably, and this, I think you see it with lots of people who start these solo endeavors, is you either have to continue to do it solo, or you need to figure out how to grow it into a regular publishing business.
And that's a really good question, because at the moment, and also, you know, in full transparency, talking about myself, so I'm very interested.
Yeah, of course.
Because it's the same question for me. What you've been building is very much based on you as a person, as a voice, as a personal brand, if you will. So if you go away, the business,
it's gone, right? Yeah, it's gone. So it's going to be buried with me.
Yeah. How can we make that work? You know, building something that creates value in the long run can maybe be sold or something.
Yeah.
Without you staying around for the rest of your life.
I think that's the biggest, you know, challenge, right? Is how do you create enterprise value when a lot of the value is tied into you as a person, right? To me, I think tying it to a person gives you an opportunity. It differentiates you in the market. But ultimately, depending on what you want to build, you have to be able to transfer that trust as a person to like the brand itself, you know? So that's why, you know, I think a lot of people want to, like, you know, just the brand name is the rebooting. It's not like my name or something like this. And, you know, ultimately, brands are built off points of view, and I think just the way you do it now is it's a point of view. Maybe it starts with the point of view of a person tied up into a person, but pretty soon, if you do it right, it should just be about the brand that is created. Like, for instance, in the U.S., there's a really popular like sports/comedy like for young men company called Barstool, and it was very tied into the creator, Dave Portnoy, but, you know, he brought in other voices, and you know, it, pretty soon it became about the brand Barstool, not just about, like, the person, and I think that's, like, a normal evolution, but some people will stick with it being just around, you know, the person, because there's a lot of advantages to that.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the, you know, that's the big question, because what I wonder is, you know, maybe a lot of these brands are not meant to last that long. Like, maybe there isn't enterprise value being created, like, or very little of it. And I think that can be okay, right? Like, I know, like, it might not be the answer, you know, you or I would want, but, you know, maybe that is the kind of businesses that will end up being built with this.
Okay, so that would mean that if, like, this great opportunity comes your way, that could be the end of the rebooting?
Oh, no, this is what I want to do. I mean, I want to build it into, like, a regular publishing brand and have colleagues and stuff. I think doing things on your own, it, you know, gets to be a drag after a while, and trying to do everything yourself is almost impossible. Mm-hmm. I think that's why, like, you know, with Substack, with subscriptions, it makes so much sense, because, you know, trying to handle sales and customer service and marketing and growth and, like, everything is it's really hard for like one person, at least right. I find it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
yeah, but okay, so then the future would look like you bring somebody else on board.
Yeah.
They would need to be paid though, right? So the business must be running pretty okay-ish by then.
Yeah.
Or would you think about, you know, getting investors involved at all?
I'm just going through options and like talking to like potential investors. Not a great time to like raise money. I don't think a lot of these businesses should need that much money,
right.
Particularly if you're in the B2B area. They should be fairly profitable early on. But you still need to, you need to hire ahead of revenue. And so you either do that through, you know, generating enough revenue so you can expand, or you can do it quicker by like getting, you know, raising a little bit of money and putting that towards hiring people ahead of when you can like generate revenue from their, the products that they're making.
But doesn't it feel to you like you're then doing the same stuff over again, you know, creating the next media company that you've already created with?
I mean, yeah, but like, you know, I think that's like, okay. I think most people, you know, they act like they're going to like create something completely different from scratch and stuff like this. You see this with Semaphore, but like when you start to scratch at it, you're like, oh, this is very similar to what you did before. Yeah. It looks a lot like Quartz. Like, I think that's like a natural path. I think there's always an opportunity to like rethink models, because any model that was like new at a time will end up becoming old, right? And like, with Digiday, you know, a lot of the competitors were stuck with magazines and old models, and so there was an advantage then to like have a different type of model. I think the same thing exists now. Like, if you're you always have these like legacy processes and legacy costs mm-hmm. that develop.
I was wondering about that. How exactly would you describe your niche? Right, it's not the Digiday crowd anymore.
I think it's like it's the people who are, it's everyone who is building sustainable media businesses. You know, right now I'm focusing on publishing, but I would expect to expand into areas like streaming, retail all right. media, all kinds of different areas. The key thing with B2B is if you can sit between a buy and a sell side, you know, and I think that is like the power of it, but it's also the risk of it, because a lot of times the publications and the brands that are built are very vendor driven. And I think the products, the content itself, can sometimes feel like an afterthought.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you can get away with that as much these days. I think there's a lot of, I think one of the reasons there's a lot of focus on B2B is because there's a lot of opportunities, because a lot of the businesses haven't focused enough on their audiences or their communities. They say that they're community focused, but they're really vendor focused,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that's an opportunity.
It's also hard to do, right? If you come from a culture like that,
yeah.
To suddenly become like a community driven company.
Yeah, but I think the strongest brands being built are all built around communities these days.
Hmm.
I don't see why that wouldn't apply to media more broadly, and also within media, B2B is perfect for like communities and community models.
Love to hear it, because my newsletter is actually about community marketing. So
yeah, I mean, the problem is a lot of people use the word community when they really have like an audience, if that. It's just, it becomes like a buzzword. But when it's real, and to me, the test of a community is, do the people want to connect with each other under your auspices? You know, like, can you convene groups? That's why live events are so critical. Because the way I'm looking at like the model is like, newsletters I really like because there's a direct connection that you have with the individual. The email inbox is a very personal space, so you feel like more of a connection than you do like on a web page. And podcasts are the same because of the human voice You know, you get people come up to you like, oh, I listen to you when I'm walking my dog and stuff. And I think live events are important too, because connecting with people on a human level is more important than ever, I think, coming out of the pandemic when we couldn't. And those kind of businesses are, I think, by definition, more sustainable than the kinds of businesses that have been built over the last, media businesses that have been built over the last decade, which were very focused for the most part on scale and on advertising. So hopefully better things will emerge from this era.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, in the last few years, subscriptions and memberships have been, you know, the go-to business model.
Yeah.
And listening or reading you,
yeah,
you're saying there's almost too much focus on that particular business model. And
I think so. I mean, if you look at and it really depends on a lot of the niches, but in like B2B, you can make money so many different ways beyond subscriptions. I think the biggest impact of the focus on subscriptions is forcing these brands to be customer focused and the customer being the audience, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so when the audience moves from being someone whose attention you sell, whose like data you sell, and basically, to someone who's paying you, you start to treat them a lot better. And that's why there's so much advantages to having a subscription model beyond just subscriptions, right?
Changes because the content, right?
It changes the organization, to me. Like, the organization will have to be focused on the audience. Whereas when the customer is just the vendor, you know, that's who you're going to cater to.
I think, you know, both the United States market as well as the European markets.
Mm-hmm.
And you used to spend quite a lot of time in between continents, yeah, so to speak. What's the difference? I mean, we in Europe tend to see the you know, everything that's happening in the US as a kind of looking at our own future just a few years,
yeah,
faster. Is that how you're seeing it, or are there more structural differences?
I mean, look, the biggest like difference with the US market is just how big and deep it is. Like, you know, like over, I can just, you know, I'm like, growing up as like a kid, like I remember when like the US was like, you know, it passed like 250 million people. It was like 340 million people. It's like, and the US market has grown so much faster, I feel like, than the European market, that like one of the big challenges of like a US business, I remember when we sort of came to like Europe, is like things are smaller, like the deal sizes are smaller, and there's a lot of advantages to be coming from a very big market like that. I mean, Germany's massive within like the European Union, but like the US is a really big country, and there's a lot of challenges to that across the society, but there's a ton of like advantages to me. But I think the challenges are very similar. It's not like the US is ahead of Europe. It's like in some areas, yeah, but like we're entering into an era where industrial policy is very, very active. Government and regulation is common, and in the US too.
We're first in that space.
Yeah, and like, you know, it's sort of said as like maybe as a little bit of an insult by some like US VC types, but like Europe has long been a regulatory superpower. Right? When GDPR...
It's easier if you're regulating another continent, right? It's basically to regulate US companies.
I mean, look, the US tech companies will just be like, well, this is just Europe because they lost this. You know, they didn't develop the same businesses like Google and Facebook and Apple and whatnot. There's probably truth to that. But when you look at like GDPR and the leadership that Europe has had in reining in the sort of rampant use of data, it was never taken seriously in the US, never taken seriously until GDPR. Like, companies were shocked that GDPR, that they were responsible for any of this. And, you know, that's just a cultural thing and stuff. You know, the U.S. is very laissez-faire with the approach to the government's role in the economy. But that's all changing now. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, like, we're moving more towards a European model than vice versa. Like, it used to be like the U.S., you know, was dragging Europe into like this sort of like Anglo model of like extreme mm-hmm. free markets.
It's but maybe a phase of consolidation a little bit, right? The big innovations are very far away, it seems, like Web3 and Metaverse and stuff like that.
I wonder about that, because like if you look at like AI, it feels like, I mean, it's been like happening forever, but like the actual use cases of AI, particularly when it comes to like media creation, mm-hmm. have just exploded, I feel like, in the last few months.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at what's coming down the pike with GPT-3 and the OpenAI stuff, it's just like every week something new comes out.
Did you see this word processor that kind
of launched
yesterday or something?
Yeah, Lex.
Lex, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of scary to some degree. And like that is, but that's going to be the future. This, you know, being able to be like an augmented like creator. And like, that's where I think is going to get really interesting. I think people will focus on disinformation and stuff like this. And that's undeniably part of it. But I saw some estimate that 90% of digital content is going to be synthetic mm-hmm. within the next 5 years.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And
I mean, there's another question about regulation and stuff. That's where the Europeans will
come in pretty quickly. You're going to lead the charge. but like, look at AI. Like, so what I wonder is like how AI is going to develop, and really it's going to explode in the next few years in a totally different environment than when previous technologies were developing, because there's just so much more heightened awareness of the downsides of technology, and that it's going to be regulated from the beginning. Mm. Whereas usually, particularly when innovations come in a U.S. context, the government just lets it like go and sees what happens, and then like regulation is the last choice. But now it's going to start from the beginning, and particularly.
Because it feels so scary too, right?
Yeah, I think
magic and great, but also you can see the escalation to something really dark.
Well, yeah, I think we've always, as humans, been like very distrusting of, I mean, I don't know, we're like all, like, technology is the only thing that got us out of caves, right? Like, mastering technology is what being a human is about. And at the same time, there's always been this undercurrent of being fearful of technology replacing us or having the upper hand on us. I mean, that's why it's
what's... That's what journalists seems to be a topic, right? They're so afraid that all of a sudden, like, a computer will...
Yeah, but it never,
get
you know...
...get the scoop or something.
Yeah, it rarely has happened, but I understand why, like... But at the same time, it's also... it's like people love automation when it's happening to other people. Like, nobody cared, like, you know, when globalization, everyone, you know, was like, oh, we got to globalize, you know, and all the factories were getting closed in Ohio and stuff. You know, people were okay with that. It's like, well, that's just how the market, but then all of a sudden when like AI starts to like write newsletters and do podcasts, it's like, hold on a sec, let's...
Oh man, yeah, actually you're right. They could do podcasts.
Did you see one, podcast.ai?
No.
It did a podcast of Joe Rogan interviewing Steve Jobs.
Oh man.
It was able to comb through the different, and it's like, it's not perfect, but I mean, this is going to be the hard part with regulation and disinformation and stuff like this, but you know, you can see that
it's going to be perfect pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, if it's, I'm surprised at how far along some of these AI tools are. I thought it was going to be super clunky for a long time, but this stuff is like here. It's not like Web3 or Metaverse. Metaverse, you can like sort of hit the snooze button for a decade.